lockdown was responsible for many things. One of the most minor ones was that I was originally meant to deliver this in December 2020. And then Boris intervened. As a result, I'm afraid two or three of you already know what it's going to say. So I'm particularly, I suppose, encouraged, maybe, that you should come anyway. But actually, looking at it, there's one small benefit to the delay, because I happen to see that my very first sentence talks about a new king on the throne. So maybe it's appropriate we've delayed. Okay. England seemed very foreign to its new king, George, newly come from Hanover in 1715, unable to speak the language, and finding some customs incomprehensible. For example, during Lent, which he supposed should be observed solemnly, he was confronted by a courtier, suddenly rising up, right up on tiptoes, arms flailing, head thrown back, screeching dementedly. The shocked king speedily abolished the post of royal cock crower, a dignitary whose undignified antics were meant to remind us of Peter's denials. That raucous dumb show was no loss, since it perpetuated a misunderstanding. Cockerels were forbidden in Jerusalem. Cock crow was the nickname for the gallicinium, a bugle call issuing from the Romans' garrison, Castle Antonia, signal to change the guard at the end of the night's third watch. And anyway, we don't need a dumb show to remind us. We all know this part of Peter's story. What isn't widely appreciated, though, is how innovative this passage is, purely as a piece of writing. The literary historian Eric Auerbach pointed out it's a prime instance of the Gospels doing something unprecedented, which truly was a turning point in civilization. Just as it was said of Jesus, no one ever spoke like this, so too, before Jesus' followers, no one ever wrote like this. It's extraordinary because the characters are ordinary. A provincial fisherman and a serving girl, some bystanders joining in later. In previous literature, attention is on important persons. Speeches are set-piece rhetoric or highbrow dialogue, not brief exchanges between nobodies. Previously, common people provide moments of comic relief or pastoral colour, or they voice support for leaders, but they have no importance in themselves. One-dimensional pawns making no significant choices. In previous literature, they're just ciphers. They simply conform to type. Not so Peter. Jesus didn't call him rock for being consistent, impetuously committed, then vacillating, boldly right, then weakly wrong. The church historian Adolf von Harnack described him by the word pendulation, swinging to and fro, rocky in both senses. Someone ordinary and prone to inconsistency, like most of us. You may have noticed that. Even if you weren't aware, such people are only written about once Jesus took them seriously, as having choices which could change who they were, especially their choices regarding himself. But what exactly was Peter's choice? Why deny knowing Jesus? Why do so with oaths, according to Matthew and Mark's accounts, even invoking a curse against himself? The context rules out cowardice. Hours earlier, in the upper room, Peter pledged his willingness to die for Jesus. Minutes earlier, in Gethsemane, he proved it. His sword against a troop of trained soldiers. The Greek word suggests a large number, maybe more than 100. However, Jesus diffused that situation, ordering Peter to sheath his sword, healing Malchus, whom Peter had struck. And then, before he allowed himself to be taken, Jesus secured agreement that his followers would go free. So Peter was actually safe and knew it. Tracking them needed nerve, but not courage. Or do you imagine the men in the courtyard might so soon have reneged on the agreement? That they might so soon... Shall I wait a moment? Do you imagine the men in the courtyard might so soon have reneged on the agreement and might have attacked Peter? Then why didn't they? How did it protect Peter to protest he never knew Jesus, especially when he was obviously lying? Doubtless he was derided, but he wasn't in danger. So, if it wasn't physical fear, what was it provoked such a sudden, panicked pendulation? We mustn't underestimate how much easier it is for us, with the advantage of hindsight, aware what ensued: Calvary, Easter, Pentecost, the coming into being of the church. The fact is, contemporaries struggled to make sense of Jesus. People hung on his words, sensing they were momentous, but often were bewildered. His eschatology, like all eschatology, was almost impossible to pin down precisely. And while some of his teaching was wonderfully lucid, some was tantalizingly elusive. Some parables were baffling enough, let alone what he said about himself, and what additionally he might or mightn't have been implying, both by his deeds as well as his words. Peter was as close to Jesus as anyone. He'd heard the Baptist endorse Jesus, although even the Baptist was rather perplexed. Peter had seen his mother-in-law's healing and numerous other miracles, knew God worked through Jesus, knew it was scribal libel to credit such deeds to Beelzebub, learned that we should forgive 70 times seven times. When he was scooped out of the sea back into the boat, the awed disciples acclaimed Jesus truly Son of God. And at Caesarea Philippi, Peter hailed him as Messiah. But hearing and revering didn't entail understanding Jesus's role or how it would be fulfilled. Caesarea Philippi showed what Peter could and couldn't take in. Yes, Jesus certified his words as genuine revelation from God, yet anathematized his very next words as not of God, but of men, as if Peter was Satan. Peter simply couldn't align two strands which Jesus was increasingly stressing, shining affirmations that he would soon be glorified, and the Transfiguration testified the truth of that, side by side with dark forebodings that he would soon be slain ignominiously. That unthinkable juxtaposition featured again and again in the hours leading up to Peter's arrival at the high priest's gate. Had there ever been a more bewildering evening? We've time to review only a few moments on the roller coaster. Jesus, toast of the town that week, the topic of conversation in the capital, began the night by insisting he wash the disciples' feet like a servant. Yet, nothing could be less servile than declaring during the meal that he was inaugurating a new covenant, a fresh contract between God and man, linked to himself. Yet frighteningly, he linked it to his body and blood. And had he said broken body, he warned the disciples they'd be scattered, yet almost made light of it, saying they'd soon rejoice, and promising them thrones in his kingdom. Triumphantly, he proclaimed, "My time is at hand," reassuring them they needn't be troubled. Yet evidently he was troubled himself. In Gethsemane, acknowledged being sorrowful even unto death, and sweated blood. From the sound of his prayers there, he might have been in two minds, yet was utterly resolved to face an imminent crisis he wasn't looking forward to, and yet was. Jesus was saying such seemingly conflicting things, so thrilling and so terrifying by turns. Everything must have seemed at once vivid and opaque, nightmarishly so. Even his direct statements to disciples might, just might, be ambiguous. Offered two swords, he said, "It's enough." But was that a refusal or confirmation it would suffice? The appalling accusation of betrayal was aimed at Judas, but Judas is told to act straight away. And immediately after he'd gone, Jesus announced now he would be glorified. So was there a plan, one to which Judas was perhaps privy, perhaps because he held the purse? Moreover, when Jesus kept painfully repeating, "Peter, you will deny me, Peter, you will deny me," was that too part of a plan? A covert instruction, perhaps? Finally, when Jesus repels those come to capture him, causes them to falter and fall back by identifying himself in terms staggeringly suggestive of the divine name, "I am he," yet prohibits Peter protecting him, pauses to heal Malchus, and meekly consents to be taken, was that willingness proof it was all planned? After all, he did call it God's cup for him. And then, bemused but still loyal Peter arrives at the gate, knowing himself safe, desperately anxious though for Jesus. And Peter must have been quite astonished to find himself let in. What's more, astonishing still, find himself being let in courtesy of another disciple whose identity is key to what occurs. Commentators invariably suggest it was John, who always elsewhere in the Gospel is referred to indirectly as the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved. And it's speculated he gained entry to the high priest's house because John had priestly connections. Polycrates, a second century bishop of Ephesus, recalled John, who passed his last years in Ephesus, having worn the petalon, meaning leaf, flower, blossom, wreath, a term for the gold plate inscribed "Holy to the Lord" attached to a Jewish priest's turban. And remember, John's mother Salome, along with her sister the Virgin Mary, was a kinswoman of Elizabeth, married to Zechariah, a priest of the division of Abijah, and herself of the daughters of Aaron. However, would those connections recommend John to Annas, the high priest? Hardly. Zechariah was merely a minor rural priest who, decades before, when briefly serving in the temple, was temporarily dumbstruck by an angelic vision. To Sadducees, running the temple, since they didn't accept angels as part of their religion, that must have been a great embarrassment, made more acute by his becoming Father of the Baptist, whom the Sadducees wouldn't countenance. Yes, John's family were well off, enough to employ hired servants, enough for Salome to contribute financially to Jesus' ministry. But that wouldn't guarantee access to Annas' clan, most aloof of the super-rich Sadducees, and also the most notorious. Annas, although deposed as high priest by Valerius Gratus, Pontius Pilate's predecessor, continued to exercise control through his family. As well as Caiaphas, his son-in-law, no fewer than five of Annas's sons became high priest. Apart from two short breaks, the dynasty ran the temple and dominated Jewish religious affairs continuously from AD 7 right until AD 62, when the last son was deposed for having James the Just illegally stoned. And they were so dishonourable that the Talmud, the Jewish record made a couple of centuries later, the Talmud curses them as having serpent hissings. Really, there's no evidence John was on good terms with them, no more than there's evidence that his relatives, Jesus and John the Baptist, were. And even if John was acquainted with them, why admit John in the middle of the night? And on this night of all nights? And what authority would John have to have Peter admitted? Bear in mind, no account of Gethsemane suggests John hadn't fled. Above all, why just this once? Would the gospel writer not describe John as one whom Jesus loved? No, we must discount John. And then everything falls into place. Who is this other disciple? Ask, who of the 12 was last named in the narrative? Who wasn't with the 11 in the garden? Who left, though, along with Jesus, and so would have been at the house before Peter? Whom did the high priest definitely know? The Greek word implies more than just an acquaintance. Who had met with the high priest that week? Whom would the serving girl therefore know was a disciple before guessing that Peter might be one also? Who had authority to let Peter in, having directed the arresting posse? It all fits. The question is why Judas wanted Peter inside. And why did that precipitate Peter's pendulation? Jesus was being subjected to a hostile hearing before Annas and Caiaphas, working through the night, trying to compile incriminating evidence so as to build a case, so as to justify charges, so as to secure a conviction at a cursory trial the next morning, having already decided on the verdict and the sentence that it was expedient this one man die for the sake of the people. However, the Sadducees were floundering, having to rely on witnesses, because Jesus, as was his right, was saying nothing they could use. There was testimony he disrupted the temple, chased off money changers, boasted he'd miraculously rebuilt it in 3 days. But had he said rebuild it after he destroyed it? On decisive details, witnesses disagreed. And anyway, such issues couldn't support a capital charge warranting the Romans being brought in to execute the death penalty. Specifically, Annas and Caiaphas needed Jesus to have claimed to be Messiah, or allowed that claim to be made for him. For while it's a moot point whether the claim was illegal under Jewish law, probably it was legal. Nevertheless, it could be presented with a little twisting to look like insurrection to the Romans. Judas could be one witness. However, Jewish law required at least 2 witnesses to concur. And then Judas spots Peter outside, perfect as the second witness. So have the serving girl bring him in. However nonplussed he'd been till then, Peter would have taken in this situation fast, with a hostile hearing underway. Were he to report Caesarea Philippi truthfully, Jesus would be doomed. Was this why Jesus had charged the disciples to tell no one? Was this perhaps why Jesus had warned Peter that very night, "Where I'm going, you cannot follow"? Suddenly, Peter would have been very afraid for his Lord's life, not his own. Panicking, his own words, ones Jesus verified were revelation from God, would be used to condemn Jesus to death. The awful alternative was to doom himself, not to death, but very possibly to damnation. Initially, he might stall by simply lying. But to avoid being put on oath, to avoid being put in the dock, he'd have to deny it with oaths, at whatever cost to his soul. Even if it were tantamount to cursing himself, he would save Jesus. And Peter's ploy almost succeeded, only failing because the high priest also failed. Unable to assemble credible, discreditable evidence against Jesus, the high priest forced Jesus, hitherto silent, forced Jesus to speak by doing what wasn't permitted. Matthew's gospel explains that the high priest forced Jesus to speak, abjuring Jesus in the name of the living God to answer whether he was Messiah and Son of God. And the high priest received a reply, refused to heed it, and rent his robes. Thus, Peter's denials fail. Judas's betrayal succeeds. The outcome, though, in both cases was decided not by their actions, but by Jesus declaring himself. And the result were opposite to what might be expected. Judas repents, but without appealing for God's mercy, and so, left only with self-recrimination, kills himself. Whereas, weeping bitterly, broken, seeming the likelier suicide, Peter must still have been looking towards Jesus. For Luke's gospel says, when cockcrow ran out, he saw Jesus turn to look at him. Exactly what that look conveyed, we're not told. But Peter survived till Easter, and Easter reinvigorated him. Let me end by drawing 2 lessons, necessary counterweights to my suggesting that Peter denied Jesus from the best of intentions. Firstly, Peter was entirely wrong, because our calling is to witness to Jesus, notwithstanding any worries we have over whether that might prove counterproductive. Subsequently, Peter learned better, although even after Easter and Pentecost, progressing from fisher of men to shepherd of the sheep to pillar of the church, there were still occasions he suffered pendulations. But as Jesus told him, although feet may still need washing, we have been bathed. Even serious mistakes, even sinful mistakes, aren't the last word. Not so long as we keep looking, as Peter had but Judas hadn't, keep looking to Jesus, whose judgment on the disciples in Gethsemane was that their spirit is willing, albeit the flesh is weak. Key to re-establishing ourselves on rock when we've been rocky is continuing spiritually, looking unto Jesus, author and completer of our faith. Secondly, it's conspicuous. Follow me are Jesus' first words to Peter in Mark's Gospel. In John's Gospel, the risen Christ's final words to Peter are also, follow me. Yet, in between, in this particular night, he was categorical that where I'm going you cannot follow. Adding, although you will hereafter. Our advantage of hindsight solves the puzzle. One thing Jesus had to do alone, since only he could, secure the new covenant for us by going to the cross, which is just what Peter strove to stop. That's the second way he was entirely wrong. The issue is, who saves whom and how? Peter's readiness to lay himself down for Jesus resulted in ruin. Instead, he had to wait for Jesus laying down his life for us. Our best intentions and efforts save neither Jesus nor ourselves. Instead, we must first accept his saving us in his way, by his cross. Peter's willingness to curse himself was in vain. Jesus' willingness to be accursed or appear accursed at Calvary is efficacious. Once Jesus is accepted, not simply as leader or teacher, but as saviour to us, thereafter we participate in the new covenant, buoyed by the risen Christ and thereby gifted the Holy Spirit, we can then follow afresh, sharing his yoke, taking up our little crosses in the strength of his cross. That's why ordinary and imperfectly consistent people began to matter. Their immediate impact on the world may be negligible or unnoticed. Or even if it's notable, what makes people matter is their horizons extend beyond the world. If here they accept being given salvation of their souls, there awaits an unfading crown of glory simply for responding to Jesus. Auerbach was much impressed that they began to be written about in literature. Infinitely more important is that people's names can be written in the Lamb's Book of Life. People, even those who may have begun as nobodies, if they put their trust in Jesus, go, as Peter's epistle puts it, from being nobodies, from being no people, to becoming a people for God's very own possession, chosen to declare his wonderful deeds.